One of the characteristics of legend, as opposed to historical accounts, characteristic of legendary accounts, is the improvements that are placed into the story. All manner of improvements take place as stories are retold with only a scant concern for truth, improvements that especially take place in regards to people, to the heroes within the story. They grow considerably larger as the villains become more and more caricatured. It is with interest, then, that you can read the histories of the apostles in the legendary period of the 3rd and 4th centuries, when the apostles start to be indeed wonder men, intermediaries, even to some extent rivals for Jesus, in that you can pray to them, and in praying to them come close to worshipping them. But as the stories are retold, indeed more than retold, as new stories are made up, the apostles are flawless wonder men. What confidence then we have in the authenticity of the New Testament documents when we read of the dunderheads that are called apostles here in the gospel accounts. We see them with their flaws, we see them with their warts. We see them as real human beings with very little to their credit. In fact, nothing to their credit. They are just like us. Not very smart. It helps us in our confidence in the authenticity of the accounts. It helps us in being able to identify with them as real people, struggling with their faith in Jesus as we struggle with our faith in Jesus. It helps us to see that someone like Peter, who opens his mouth in order to change feet, is someone who can be an apostle of the gospel of Jesus Christ, one of his people. It helps us in our identification with them, and it helps us to see that we're not dealing with legend when we're reading the New Testament accounts. There's no attempts to polish them up, make them better than they are. Or if there are attempts to do that, they must have been absolutely beyond belief in terms of hopelessness, for they really come across quite badly. When we come to the 9th chapter in the Gospel of Luke, we come to the turning point of the Gospel, and that is why, after we take our short excursion into evangelism next week, we cease our series to pick up, I presume, next year, God willing, the later section of the Gospel. We've seen Jesus preaching the kingdom of God from chapter 4 through chapter 9, doing his miracles, preaching and teaching, exorcising and healing, and constantly proposing to people a terrible question as to who he is and whether they will be with him in this kingdom of his that he proclaims. But in chapter 9, as we reach the climax of it, the concentration falls much more upon Jesus and the apostles and the 12 and their relationship with him. Initially, they enjoy great success. They are sent out as the 12 ambassadors to do the same works that Jesus did, preaching, driving out demons, curing diseases, as is described in verse 1. And they accomplish the mission they're sent on. And so in verse 6 we read of them doing it. They did the same things that Jesus did, and as a result the news and fame of Jesus spread quickly. Even Herod the Tetrarch heard of Jesus and wanted to interview Jesus. All kinds of rumours were spread abroad because now his work was being done, multiplied by 12. The disciples in this chapter have other successes too. Well, another success anyway. That is, all the people were wondering who Jesus was. And as they were giving their various answers, verse 19, John the Baptist, Elijah and somebody else, but verse 20, Peter it is who says, "You are the Christ of God. You are the Messiah of God." It was the disciples who recognized Jesus for who he was. That is what makes this such a turning point in the account of the gospel. For now Jesus, recognized as the Messiah, starts to do his messianic work in seriousness. Now he turns his face to Jerusalem to be executed. Now he starts preaching of suffering, of persecution, and of death. The character of the gospel is now to change. Once recognized as the Messiah, the whole event changes its character. And it is the disciples who recognize him to be the Messiah. But their failures are far more often recorded. They couldn't think of the possibility of feeding 5,000 out in the wilderness from 5 loaves and 2 fish. And cast out evil spirits, yes, you can do that. You can heal people of various diseases, yes, you can do that. You can preach so as to draw crowds of thousands, yes, you can do that. But you can't feed people in the wilderness. The Lord couldn't do that. Likewise, with the incident of the boy with the evil spirit, in verses 37 following, the father took him to the disciples, but they could not drive out this demon. This was beyond them. They were part of that perverse generation of unbelievers whom Jesus had to endure. So their failures are recorded quite clearly. But in the failures, we see their blindness. Their blindness at seeing who it was that could make bread in the wilderness. Their blindness not to perceive Jesus' power over all evil. Great was their blindness. And in each event, even though they may not have taken any action or failed in any action, we see them blinded. The Transfiguration in verses 28 through 36 is a great event of the blindness of the disciples, the three that are there. Or they were sleepy and they woke up and there it had all happened in front of them, and it was a bit confusing, no doubt, and I can't imagine that I would have done anything except for Peter, who opened his mouth to talk first and think later. I can quite appreciate that. I've never had any difficulty identifying with that kind of activity. But they were blinded nonetheless. He wants to build 3 shelters, one for Moses, one for Elijah, one for Jesus, to capture the moment, not having a video replay, of course, machine. He wanted to capture the moment. He wanted things to stay exactly where they were. He saw the Messiah, and now he sees the Messiah glorified. We have arrived. This is the point. This is the final state. Let us capture it. Let us build it. But what they were talking about there, Elijah and Moses and Jesus, was not the arrival, but the exodus. The word is translated departure in our translation here in front of us. But the word is the exodus. He hadn't arrived because he hadn't yet suffered. His time hadn't come for him to be killed in Jerusalem. They didn't understand him at all. The light was so splendid. They had missed the point completely. And the voice from God corrects them. It's in stark contrast that they then go down to the boy who is contaminated by evil, who is under the sway fully of darkness. And again, they're blind there. A blind unbelief that cannot see the Lord in his power exorcising this one. But their blinding in that situation is more than that. For as the crowds marvel at him, as they have been doing chapter after chapter, event after event, Jesus says to the disciples the new message, which is just for those who recognize the Messiah. He says, I'm going to suffer. Listen carefully to what I say to you. I tell you, the Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of men. He says, I'm going to suffer. But they don't understand that. It doesn't make sense. I can understand the amazement. I can be astonished at his power. He can do things that we yet cannot do. He can cast out evil spirits that are stubborn and resistant against us. That I can share. That I can perceive. Yes, he can do that because he's the Messiah. But when he goes on about this business of being betrayed into the hands of men, that does not compute. Cannot cope with that kind of piece of information. There's an error somewhere in the transmission. They didn't understand. And why? Because it was God's purpose for them not to understand, for it was at this stage hidden from them so that they couldn't understand it. It wasn't yet the time for them to understand everything. Does that make them innocent then? No. Because they didn't want to understand either. Their fear prevented them. It was hidden from them, verse 45, so that they did not grasp it, and they were afraid to ask him about it. They were blinded by their own fear, as well as by the purposes of God. They did not want it, or rather they wanted it, but they were more afraid than what they wanted. How often, you know, we are like it, aren't we? Our very fears prevent us from discovering truth. It may have been hidden, indeed we're told it was, but they weren't looking either. And their failure to grasp that the Messiah was going to suffer compounded itself in the way in which they treated people. For they were blinded by the false views of status and authority in verses 46 through 50 there. See, here is the Lord, here is the Messiah, here is their one that they are following, their king. And their king is saying, I am going to suffer. I am going to lay down my life for you. I'm going to be betrayed into the hands of sinful men and be killed. I'm giving away everything. And if you are going to be my disciple, you must come and take up your cross daily and follow me. The way of the Messiah is the way of laying down your life. And they're saying, well, I wonder if I'm going to be bigger or better than you in the kingdom. Which of us is going to be the mighty one? I wonder how many crowns I'm going to have, how many stars there will be in my crown, how big my seat will be, and whether I'll be sitting at the right hand or the left hand of Jesus. Here Jesus is talking of self-sacrifice, they're talking of greed and avarice, of jealousy and rivalry and envy. They haven't understood at all. They couldn't be further away from his thinking. Couldn't be further away. They're totally out of touch with where he's at. All they can think of is the conquest. All he is talking of is the destruction. Blinded by status. It's so easy to identify with them, isn't it? To be more conscious of where we fit in. What kind of importance we are given by other people. How significant we are within the kind of community around about us. Rather than being like the Lord, concerned to serve and to lay down his life for others. It's easy to identify. Wouldn't you be an apostle? It's just like it. Sinful. And blinded by the authority. Here's a bloke, he's exorcising. People are having demons driven out of them. And what's more, he's doing it in the name of Jesus. We've got to stop that. None of that going on. He's not authorised. He doesn't belong to our club. He wears the wrong kind of t-shirt. Got the wrong insignia. Well, he's got the right insignia on it, but we didn't write it. In fact, he's breaking copyright, isn't he? You must stop that at all costs. There can be no truth outside our institution. They cannot perceive the importance of glorifying Jesus and conquering evil. They can only perceive themselves and their own importance. So many of our blindnesses are covered here in theirs. The lack of faith, the fear, the fact that God doesn't always tell us everything, going hand in hand with it, the fact that we're status seekers, the fact that we try institutionalized truth, as always being orthodoxy equals my doxy. It makes them real people though, doesn't it? You can both identify with them and you can say, yeah, that's not legend. These are not the great warriors and saints that have been built up like King Arthur's. These are real people being recorded in their grotty little lives, as only someone concerned for the truth would record it. Now they're not concerned about who Jesus is. They know who that is. He's the Messiah. They've got now the right brand label on the outside of the packet. They've just got a small problem. They don't know what the product is inside. They know he's the Messiah. That's the right title, but they don't know what kind of Messiah he is. There is their perception problem. They thought they'd actually made a huge step forward, and they did. They said, yes, you're the Messiah. But what they meant by Messiah and what he meant by Messiah was so far apart that they really haven't got it at all. And there is the problem. For what kind of Messiah is he? Is he going to be the political revolutionary? Is he going to be the pacifist, working in peaceful civil disobedience? Is he going to be a revivalist preacher of some kind? Well, already they know some of the things he does. They know he preaches the kingdom of God. They know he goes exorcising. They know that he does miracles of healing and the like. And not only they know those things, they have learnt them sufficiently to do them themselves. They've been authorised by him, sent out to do the very same things he was doing. So they know something of what he is doing. Therefore, they think they know everything of what he is doing. Although the manna should have warned them, shouldn't it? There he is feeding the multitude out in the desolate place like Moses. Not much is made of it in Luke's gospel. But yet the one who is greater than Moses is clearly here. Let me just give a small sidetrack at this point, because people make much of this which is irrelevant. And this little side point is irrelevant to the sermon, so if you're a good sleeper, this is the time to have it. Because Jesus takes the 5 loaves in verse 16 and the 2 fishes and looks up to heaven. He gave thanks and broke them. Then he gave them to the disciples and set before the people. Because that's what he does, many people say this is a reference to the Lord's Supper. Because he takes it, he looks up to heaven and gives thanks, he breaks it and he gives. And so it is just like the Lord's Supper. Rubbish. There are so many dissimilarities. I've been to communion in churches all over the land in all kinds of denominations, and they've never given me fish yet. Although some would deny me the wine, as they don't make any reference to the wine here, I presume it was lacking. That's rubbish. You see, every time that Jesus or a godly man of the first century would have a meal, he would say grace. And when he says grace, what he will do is look up to heaven and give thanks and break the food and pass it around. Indeed, in Acts chapter 27, you'll find Paul doing it on the ship that is being shipwrecked amongst 276 pagans. That was not the Lord's Supper he was celebrating there. But when it describes how he had the meal, it describes it in exactly the same terms. He looks up to heaven and gives thanks to God, breaks it and gives it to them. Well, he doesn't give it to them because they didn't want to eat it. He just leaves it on the table, they come and take it. But the principle is exactly the same. It is just the way of describing a man saying grace. It's got nothing to do with the Last Supper. The Last Supper will be described. That's a few chapters away when the time comes for the Last Supper. The feeding of the 5,000 has got nothing to do with it at all. The reason people want it to have something to do with it is because it's in John's Gospel, and in John's Gospel he talks all about eating me and living. And so therefore those who have got weird views of the sacrament of the Lord's Supper take great delight in John 6, and therefore they find it in Luke 9 and all kinds of other places. But it's garbage. Now, back on the point though. What is it referring to? It's got to do with manna in the wilderness. See, we mustn't read church history back into the New Testament. What we've got to read is the New Testament back into the Old Testament. Not to understand the New Testament, look to your Old Testament, don't look to church history. That's not the fundamental place you find out about it. That's just where you find out where people go wrong in their understanding of it. But in the Old Testament, you understand what's being referred to. God provides bread out in the wilderness. Here is the last great sign for the disciples before they recognize Jesus as the Messiah, when he breaks bread out in the wilderness and feeds the multitude of the faithful. But what kind of Messiah is he going to be? He's going to be the Messiah who suffers. For immediately they recognize him to be the Messiah. In verse 22, he starts teaching them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, chief priests, teachers of the law, must be killed and on the third day raised to life. What kind? A suffering kind, before the judgment comes. But it doesn't sound like much suffering, 3 days, and then he raises to life again. Surely they wouldn't think that's much suffering. Surely they would think that that's teaching the conquering Jesus. My friends, again, that's because we're reading back from our side of the coin rather than theirs. The resurrection to them was the final judgment. And Jesus says, I'm going to be put to death and then rise again in 3 days. They'll say, aha, he's going to be put to death and then the end of the world 3 days later. It wouldn't have occurred to them that his resurrection would predate the end of the world by a few thousand years. That would not be within their thinking. You remember in John chapter 11, when Lazarus is dead, Mary and Martha are mourning, and Jesus comes to Martha and says, what about the resurrection? She says, oh yeah, I know that he will rise on the last day. Jesus said, no, I am the resurrection. She's happy to believe in resurrection. She's happy to believe he'll rise again. But that just means he's going to come to heaven. That's just the way of talking about going to heaven. And so they will not hear that Jesus is actually saying he's going to be executed and 3 days later come back to life again and be seen by them. They will not hear that. All they hear is that in this lifetime he's going to be killed. And indeed, Jesus enjoins it on anyone who would come after him in verse 23, that if they're going to follow the Messiah, they must follow the suffering Messiah, because that is the Messiah that is there to follow. The suffering Messiah. And he calls upon them to take up their cross daily and follow him. And again at the Transfiguration, they see the Messiah who is there in all his glory with Moses and Elijah discussing his death, his departure that he is going to fulfill in Jerusalem, his exodus. It is the Messiah in glory who is the sufferer. Peter wants to preserve the Messiah of glory. But then the glory of the Lord's cloud comes down around them, and when the cloud lifts, there is only Jesus left alone. But within that, they hear the voice of God, the voice that was heard at the baptism of Jesus, again linking Psalm 2, the great messianic psalm, with Isaiah 42, the suffering servant. The voice clearly identifies this Messiah as the suffering servant. That is who it will be, the suffering Messiah. And then again, after he has done this tremendous miracle that no one else could do, not even the disciples could do, it would seem, so that all were amazed and the crowd was still marveling, he again tells his disciples that he is going to suffer. It is the suffering Messiah who, in verse 51, resolutely sets out for Jerusalem. He put his mind, his heart, his life to that great place of sacrifice. I think it is too easy for us at this point to be hard in our judgment of the apostles and their slowness of wit. I'm sure we would not have understood it if we were there either. We may not have even understood who he was, but if we were there and had grasped hold of that, it would have been incredible to ever grasp the possibility that he was the kind of Messiah who gets killed. We know the story very well, and from hindsight we can be very wise. All the more extraordinary that the apostles are written up from the vantage of ignorance, from the viewpoint of being on the other side of the cross, when they couldn't have known, when it couldn't make sense to them, didn't make sense to them. And they're left floundering around in blindness. Here is the problem of perceiving properly. Their expectations of the Messiah would not allow them to perceive what kind of Messiah Jesus was, even when it allowed them to perceive that Jesus was the Messiah. But true perception of the Messiah, to perceive him truly as the sufferer, will lead to three different things in this chapter: commitment, listening, and accepting. Commitment's the one that we'll look at next week in some detail. For as soon as Jesus is perceived to be the Messiah, he sets out that he is to be the sufferer, and then he tells them what is required of them, to be the sufferers with him, to be the suffering servants of the suffering King, is what is going to be required of them, to be really committed to him, irrespective of the circumstances of life. It's the message that is still part and parcel of what it is to be a Christian, and that is why we'll spend next week on it. To see Jesus rightly as the King who suffers, leads a person into a right relationship with Jesus as one thoroughly committed to the King who gladly takes the suffering of the cross upon himself. The second thing that true perception of Jesus should lead to is listening. For when the voice speaks from the cloud, "This is my Son, whom I have chosen," the command also comes, "Listen to him." It's back in Deuteronomy, chapter 18 and verse 15, that God promises another Moses, another prophet like unto Moses. "The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among your brothers. You must listen to him." What do you do to prophets? Well, the history of Christianity and Judaism before it has been to kill them. But what you're supposed to do is listen to them. That's what you're supposed to do with prophets, to take heed of what they say, for they tell you what God says. "Here is indeed God's Son, the ultimate prophet, greater than Moses, who comes as the fulfillment of that prophecy of the great prophet, like unto Moses, and the voice from God says, listen to him." We spoke of listening last week in chapter 8, and the variety of ways in which people don't listen to him and won't take in what he says. But paying heed to the words of Jesus is crucial if we're to be in right relationship with him. And if we perceive him to be the King in all his glory, who suffers for us, then we must listen to him. And finally, to truly perceive Jesus as the suffering Messiah will lead to a new perception about people, a new acceptance of them. For greatness is not in conquest, in size, in status, in authority, but in failure, in weakness, in suffering, in smallness. They want to have a great tussle about who's going to be the greatest amongst them, so Jesus gets a little kid and says, "That is the one that you accept now in my name." Why? Because all little children are perfect, innocent, pure things? Rubbish. Only people who say that nonsense are people who aren't parents. Don't go on with that garbage. Nothing to do with their purity and innocence. No, no, it's got to do with that they are of no consequence, of small amount. For greatness doesn't come by the size of the bicep, the size of the wallet or the overdraft, or the motor car you drive. That is not the nature of greatness. Not when you worship the King who was executed. In this world, the rulers of this world know how to rule with all the symbols of greatness, don't they? Their own VIP jets, their own motorcades and police escorts. They know how to rule with their flags and their greatness. Not so the people of Jesus. For the greatest thing about our Jesus, our King, was that he was executed. Our symbol has always been and must be the gallows. Shiny metal crosses are not hardly it, more like electric chairs, or is it now that we should take as a symbol the injection? For our King is the King who died. And as we start accepting people on the basis upon which he accepts us, so we become like God, who is the Father to the fatherless, who is full of mercy and compassion, and even more. So we who are weak and small and insignificant and failures, we who are nobodies in the history of mankind, just another dot, just another number in the Medibank system, we who are little and unimportant and of no value, significance to anyone, it would seem. So we stand a chance of being the kings of the world, ruling with our Master, who died for us. Acceptance changes radically.